NPR.
Hey everyone, this is The Indicator from Planet Money. I'm Cardiff Garcia. And as the summer of 2019 starts to wind down and you reflect on the big themes of the summer, you might think of the song Old Town Road by Lil Nas X, which is number one for most of the summer. Or those weird online memes about feral hogs and hot girl summer, which I'll be honest, I have no idea what that's about, but it was definitely there. But the drink that definitely dominated the summer with its popularity is White Claw. It's a hard seltzer, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's basically alcohol inside of carbonated water. This drink is popping right now, and there are all kinds of anecdotes about it. Like, there was this fraternity in Texas that apparently spent more than $7,000 in one big batch purchase of White Claw because college? I don't know. But there's an interesting story behind White Claw's popularity. It has to do not just with how it's made, but how it is taxed. And here to explain all that, based on his article for New York Magazine, is the business and economics columnist at New York, Josh Barrow. Josh, welcome back.
Hi, Cardiff. How are you?
You've been expecting a trend like this for a little while, right?
Well, or at least as soon as it happened, it was like, oh yeah, of course that happened.
Why were you expecting it?
Well, because White Claw makes sense to me as an extension of the light beer trend. Over the last few decades, beer manufacturers have come out with lighter and lighter beers with less calorie content, almost no calories, again, other than from alcohol, less body, more refreshing. And so the logical extension of that is a beer so light, it's not a beer at all. That's what White Claw is.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about White Claw, how it is made, how that contributed to its popularity, and also why the tax code, why tax policy also made a difference in its popularity right after the break.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Google Domains. Google Domains helps make your business a reality with the tools and partners for building your website like a pro and premium security features included for free. Make it happen at domains.google/NPR.
Okay, everybody, we've got Josh Barrow back in the studio. Josh, why don't we start with this? How exactly is White Claw made, and how does that differ from how other kinds of alcoholic drinks are made?
Yeah, so White Claw, even though it tastes like a vodka soda, it's not a vodka soda. It doesn't contain any vodka. So vodka, you know, you start with, you ferment a grain base, but then you have to distill it. You put it through a distillation process until typically it's 40% alcohol by volume. You boil off the alcohol, you recondense it. It allows you to get this stronger beverage. And then, you know, if you make a vodka soda, obviously you're re-diluting that again. And so the way White Claw works is they never do the concentration and redilution thing. It is just fermented like a beer. And that's how they've also made other beverages like Smirnoff Ice, Zima, Mike's Hard Lemonade, so-called malternatives. They're made from a base of grain. It can be barley or other kinds of grains. And so that gives it the malty, beery flavor that you expect in a beer. And so if you're trying to make a drink like Smirnoff Ice that isn't supposed to taste like beer at all, you have to figure out how to deal with that. And historically, what they do is they add sugar, they add very strong citrus flavors, and those mask the malty flavor. So it doesn't taste like a malt beverage. It doesn't taste like it's made like a beer, even though the production process is very similar to beer.
But there it's like you have these other flavors that are sort of overwhelming the flavor that you're trying to mask, right?
Exactly. The problem historically has been that you couldn't make something without a lot of those masking flavors because then otherwise it would have that off beery flavor that you don't want in the product. The way White Claw is different is they use a base of sugar instead of a base of grain. And when you ferment that, it's possible to achieve a more neutral flavor than you can get to if you start with a base of something like barley. So you're able to have a fermented product that you don't have to flavor intensely. They make a White Claw that's completely unflavored. And so it really tastes pretty similar to a vodka soda. I actually couldn't tell the difference. So if you're a real connoisseur, you might be able to tell the difference. But because of that sugar brewing process, it really doesn't have a lot of flavor aside from the alcohol itself.
So it kind of strikes me that there was this market demand, right? It was one that you recognized just from throwing house parties. And there wasn't a product that satisfied that demand until you had this sort of technological innovation. I mean, is it fair to call this a story of technology and a story of innovation?
Yes, it is. Although the question is, well, why not just put vodka and seltzer in a can? I mean, it's not hard to bottle pre-mixed beverages made from distilled spirits. And in fact, you do see some products like that on the market that tend to be higher end products. And you also see products like that in other countries. But in the United States, the way our tax regime around alcohol works, you have different tax rates for beer and beverages that are produced like beer. White Claw is treated as though it were a beer under the tax code.
Because it is not distilled.
Because it is not distilled, exactly.
Yeah, and that kind of brings us to the tax policy that also is partly responsible for White Claw being so popular.
Right, exactly. And so when you have the White Claw being able to pass as a beer for the purposes of the tax code, it's taxed like beer. And by the federal government, then in most states, beer is taxed at a more favorable, lower tax rate than you would have for distilled spirits. And in particular, the tax code can be very unfavorable to products like a bottled vodka soda, which is to say the tax isn't necessarily based on how much alcohol is in the beverage. So if you have a spirits product that's twice as strong, that doesn't necessarily mean it faces twice as much tax. So in a lot of places like New York, the least favorable thing you can put out there for tax purposes is a spirits product that is low in alcohol. So it becomes very difficult to pre-mix bottled cocktails that have about the same amount of alcohol as beer. In New York, you would pay about an extra $2 in taxes on a six-pack if White Claw were made actually by mixing vodka with seltzer in order to make the product, rather than through this, what they call their brew pure process.
This is kind of interesting, too, because I would imagine that extra tax, or that tax code was introduced to try to discourage people from drinking too strong beverages, but then it ended up having the effect of changing the way that the drinks are actually produced.
Yeah, I mean, so the higher tax rate on spirits is for a couple of reasons. One is what you described, the idea that spirits are more socially damaging than beer because people are more likely to use them abusively. They're more likely to get really drunk on something that's very strong. Then you also have different lobby groups that are of different that have different amounts of political juice in state capitals. California has very low taxes on wine because the wine industry is so big in California and lobbies against taxes on wine. So you have a mix of reasons for that. But yeah, in general, you have the higher taxes on spirits for a combination of those reasons. So you could theoretically have a distilled spirit product that is weaker than a beer that would still be taxed at a much higher rate.
Do you yourself drink White Claw?
I only drank it in preparation for this story.
I asked you that question in part because I myself have never tried
White
Claw. So I thought maybe I would try it right now and see how I liked it. So
oh, really?
We've got a little bit. Producer Darius Rafian's here. He's brought with him a really large can of White Claw ruby grapefruit flavor. So we're gonna try this. Are you up for trying this?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right, this is for your cup here. All right. Again, this is the ruby grapefruit flavor, so it's not the neutral flavor. We're gonna see how it is.
What do you think, Cardiff?
So, I mean, it is quite grapefruity. It does go down really easily. So you can just sort of sip it gradually throughout the night,
yeah,
and you'll be okay. You know,
yeah,
you might not be in great shape. If you're lightweight like me, it might be a problem. But at least the next day, I'm not going to wake up and think, oh, my God, what did I do? You know,
that's why it's so popular with guys in fraternities, because it's a responsible choice for sensible drinking.
It's exactly what fraternities are known for, is responsible boozing.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I find interesting about it is this is clearly a product that appeals to both men and women. And one issue you can have marketing these sorts of beverages is the question of, you know, is this feminine? Are you going to be able to convince men that they should buy this product and it doesn't make them look less masculine than if they were drinking a beer? And so I find it interesting the way it's become so associated with fraternity culture, and basically in a way of inoculating the product against that. Sort of reminds me of the Bros Icing Bros thing from a few years ago with Smirnoff Ice. And I don't know whether the brand had anything, you know, to do with trying to create those sorts of fads directly, but they definitely help with making it a more gender neutral product.
Josh Barrow, thanks so much, man.
Thank you.